As the saying goes, listeners, good things come to those who wait. And my goodness me, hasn't it been a while since the two of us were on a podcast? We are back for a brand new episode, and we've got lots to catch up on. We also get to hear from one of Badminton England's brightest prospects as we welcome another sporting guest to the show. Welcome to Sportspiel. Yes, hello listeners, and thank you for tuning in to episode 37, our first full episode for quite a while. February the 17th, by the way, was the last time we aired a proper episode for those who are counting. I am here on hosting duty, as is my cheerleading compatriot, Will Moulton. How is life?
Life has moved on since we last met, my friends.
Just a bit.
But you say we haven't had a regular episode for a long time. We've had some incredible specials in between, haven't we?
To tie us over, I think we've had quite a good catalogue of very impressive guests, first and foremost, but a lot of powerful stories in there as well.
Yeah, certainly. Rugby, football, trampolining, boxing. All of the incredible athletes that we've had on. It's certainly probably better than people having to listen to us, to be honest.
Of course. So for people who are maybe long-time listeners to the show, and you can hear some ambient background music, we're actually recording in a different location today. We're in Stratford in a coffee shop at Westfield. And the reason behind that is because a certain someone is working at Lee Valley this weekend. So we've come here for geographical reasons, because someone has to leg it to the hockey and tennis centre afterwards. What are you doing for people who may be interested?
League finals weekend, so our domestic men's and women's champions will be crowned, as well as teams being promoted to the top tier for next season. Giselle Ansley, former guest on the show, could be set to win another title with Surbiton's women. All very exciting, but one of the pitfalls of working in sport is that many, many weekends are being worked between now and the end of June.
Also brings us back to that time when we were still training and we covered the league hockey finals weekend.
What was this time 2 years ago?
2 years ago. Oh my God.
Does that make you feel old?
Just a little bit.
And now we've got the next generation of News Associates athletes on our books.
Exactly.
Conducting interviews, writing pieces. God, that makes me feel old now.
Yeah, plenty on the go. Likewise, I mean, I'm not working as many weekends as you are at the moment, but still busy in Essex Live land as well. Covered Keith Flint's funeral, for those who may have seen. It was the front man of The Prodigy, who passed away at the start of March. And his funeral was in Braintree, about 20 minutes from our office. So spent the entire day there talking to Prodigy fans, because there was a giant rave in the street. And basically they all got invited to be a part of the funeral. Big day to be a part of. And I'm also in a little bit of personal meltdown. My social life is diminishing because it's my exams next month for my senior journalism qualification, so I will be confined to my room and my desk for the foreseeable future until those are done. But happy days. Podcasts will still be coming.
I'd much rather be confined to the side of a hockey pitch, to be honest.
Maybe one day. But exam mode at the moment. Anywho, what have we got for you, the listeners, on this episode of the show? First up, we've got Yashma Dumbai, who is back on interviewing duty. And our feature interview guest this time around is Badminton England's Hope Warner. In part two, we have our news roundup, as always, followed by our discussion section. This time, we are focusing on Australian rugby international Israel Folau, who looks set to be sacked after he posted homophobic material on social media. But first, it is feature interview time. 17-year-old Hope Warner is one of Badminton England's brightest prospects. In this interview, she takes us through how she got into her sport, but also a lot of the struggles as well of competing, particularly the pressure of sometimes thinking that you're not actually good enough.
Joining me today is Hope Warner, and she's a young badminton player based in Leicester. So yeah, how are you? How are you, Hope?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. So yeah, firstly, we just wanted to know what got you into badminton and what is it about the sport that you love, really?
Well, my parents used to play sport, and they wanted me to get into it when I was quite young. So my dad played badminton, and he used to take me to go and, I guess, watch when he played at, like, club level. And I also played tennis when I was little as well. So I was very heavily into sport, but it is obviously a part of life that I really, really enjoy and still do to this day, really.
Sure. And what were some of your inspirations to the sport? Did you have any sort of role models you looked at while getting into sport?
Yeah, I think Serena Williams for me was a big one because she's obviously like shows that women can be really powerful in sport, and she's obviously been number one for quite a while now. And I guess when I was playing tennis especially, I wanted to be like her. And then in badminton, there was obviously a few people that I looked up to that I wanted to like be like and play like. So yeah, there was quite a few role models there that helped me.
Sure. And what made you switch from, say, what made you make that decision from tennis to badminton? Or was it a decision you made, or was it just something that happened naturally?
I think it was a decision that I made purely because I just enjoyed badminton more, and I actually got more nervous in tennis, like tournaments, than I did in badminton. So it was a very hard decision for me, and I was still obviously very young, probably around 10 years old. It was just because I enjoyed badminton more and I liked the sport.
Sure. And you've obviously trained regularly with people who are older than you, and you know, if you've competed with them as well, what are some of the challenges you faced with that sort of as you've gone through the levels?
It has been quite difficult at times. So when I was 11, I used to train at Leicester and Derby, and it was hard because I went over to Derby and it was high level than I was used to playing against, really. So it took me 6 months to get to know everyone there and to get used to the level of play as well. And then a few years on, I moved to Loughborough, which was obviously a much higher level there again. And it's been the same, really. I've had to take, you know, 6 months to get used to it, the intensity there. And then again, I moved to Milton Keynes, which is like the highest level you can get in England, really. So I have just got through that phase of the 6 months where you get into it and get to know everyone. But once you get past that period of time, it is really enjoyable, and you do definitely improve a lot from it.
Sure. And you said you've obviously had these kind of experiences where you've had these 6 months in terms of getting used to it. How difficult is that, and what have you been able to do in order to keep yourself motivated during that period?
I think the main thing that I found hard was, you know, that there are a lot of times when you're on your way to training and you do want to turn around and go home, really, because you're just not used to the people there and the level of play. So it's very difficult because at times you can feel like you're not good enough, you're not keeping up with the standard that they're producing, and you don't really fit in for a while, I guess. But I just persevered with it, and obviously there were days that I really didn't want to go and was in a bad mood, and then got there and just had to push myself to keep going and know that I'll improve in a few months' time, really.
Sure. And in terms of when do you feel like you're training with older people and those kind of steep learning curves, have they helped you to improve even faster to the rate where you're at now, do you think it's helped?
It's massively helped. I think that is the key to like how far I've got at the minute. Just because I've always been playing at a level higher than mine, and it's brought my level up so much quicker than it would have if I was playing with people the same age, or it just, you know, really does improve like your shot quality, the level of play, movement. You get quicker, you get faster, you get stronger, and you have to train more as the years goes on as well. So it has been tough, especially like on the body, and yeah, I have been aching constantly for the past few months. So it is tough.
Sure, and in terms of, you obviously had badminton as a hobby when you were really young and you were really starting, but now it's become a much more important than that for you. How have you been able to adapt to it sort of becoming a career, and how have you been able to adapt to that change?
I think when I was younger, you know, I kind of knew the path to the top. I knew around, you know, what it looked like. And I've just kind of gone with, you know, the training and the amount and the days that you have to, you know, the hours that you have to travel. And I do, you know, I have travelled a lot in the past and still do quite a lot now. So, you know, it's like an hour to training and then an hour back. It used to be three times a week. And so forth. So it has been quite hard, but I think it has toughened me in a way. And you do learn to deal with it. And obviously, training more and more and more does get harder and harder and harder. But I think the end result that you're looking at is, you know, that is the factor to you just keeping going. And when you have people, you know, top coaches telling you that you could have a good chance of making it, and they think that you have the potential to, it really does motivate you if you can see the end goal.
Sure. And in terms of, you've obviously achieved a lot in your short time as well in badminton, and you've been ranked number one in England and Europe for doubles, as well as being named Leicester's Mercury Young Sportswoman of the Year. So you've obviously achieved a lot. What is the thing that you're most proud of in your short time?
That's a good question. I think being European champion was definitely, I'm going to say, the highest that I've ever felt, really. The feeling of just getting through that tournament, beating so many pairs, and being able to keep a level throughout the tournament, and the mental strength just to win was, you know, the feeling was great, just knowing that your training's paid off. And I think in a team event there, we got a little disappointed with our performances, and we came third when we were hoping to come at least second. So it was tough after the team event to pick ourselves back up. But I think that's what made it even better when we won the individual.
Sure. And in terms of those achievements, how have you been able to sort of use them to sort of inspire yourself more and maybe not take them for granted in a sense, and even push further on? Have you been able to do that?
Yeah, there's a lot of times when I look back at them when I'm playing, you know, in tournaments abroad, tournaments nationally, like when I'm maybe feeling nervous or feeling worried or not playing as well as I'd like to on court, it is helpful to look back at those moments and think, you know, if you can just push yourself and keep going and keep trying the things that you've been working on, and not get too caught up in, you know, the result, I guess, is just, it is helpful, again, to look back at those times, but to also remember that, you know, you want to keep improving and you want to keep getting better. So, yeah, the feeling of winning Europeans has stuck with me for quite a while, until even now. So that's what I'm just looking to do every tournament, really.
Sure. And you've obviously, you've played doubles and singles as well. What are some of the differences with those two sort of formats, in a sense? Is it a different pressure, and is it a different sort of, is there a different mentality you have?
I think it is different. Obviously, in doubles, you've got someone on court with you, so there is that element of you've got someone else there to support you, and you know, there's also someone there for you to support, and it is difficult at times because you can get caught up in each other's feelings. And in singles, obviously, there's only you, so you've got to find the strength in you know, mental strength to motivate yourself, which is obviously can get very hard at times. I haven't played singles for a while now, but I think the key to communication and good partnership in doubles is just being able to support your partner and knowing that you can trust each other on and off court, and you have a good relationship with them off court as well, because I think it really does help when you're on court, because you know you're winning for each other. If you lose, you lose as a pair. You want to get better as a team, so it is a lot different.
Sure, and you know, and you said ahead of a championship at the start of last year, you were only, when you were playing doubles, that you were only focused on sort of helping your partner. How were you able to sort of you know, take away from your own sort of performance and just completely focus on that? Because it shows a lot of dedication to a team aspect in what some people may say is quite an individual sport. How were you able to sort of show that, really?
Yeah, I think obviously it's very hard when you're playing and I guess you might not be happy with your own performance. It is difficult to not focus on yourself and to focus on your partners. But really, if you want the best out of maybe a game or a set or a match or a tournament, then it is vital to be able to support your partner with, you know, good, whether it's motivation or just cheering them up or things like that. I think it also helps in team events as well, because obviously you're playing as a team, you win as a team. So obviously if you lose your match and you come off and you sit there and you don't really support anyone else, then you know it's not really great for the team, because they might start to lose because they're not getting enough support. So it has just been a lot of years of learning and experience with knowing what to do and what to say to people, because if you get it wrong or you don't even really try and support, then it can just have a really negative effect sometimes. And obviously I've been on trips away where the environment in the team hasn't been great and we haven't done so well in team events. So it is, you know, I've learned in the past that it is crucial, if you know you want to do well, that you support whoever you're playing with or your teammates.
Sure, and how have you been able to sort of create that bond with your pairings and the people that you're in team with? How have you been able to do that? Do you have any sort of secrets or some strategies to do that, or is it just...
I wouldn't say there's any secrets to it, really, but I think just the key is definitely communication. And as I say, again, support. So even off court, you know, if you can talk about really, you know, tactics, badminton, general life, really, then you have a much better chance of, you know, working well together on court. If you have a good off court relationship, if you trust each other, if there's, you know, good communication there, and you know that if you're down, your partner's going to be able to support you, then, you know, that is the key, really.
Sure. And previously, you just mentioned in this that you're training now at the National Badminton Centre in Milton Keynes. How is that going, and how do you feel about being able to train with the best in the country, really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is really what I've been working towards, so it feels really amazing to be down there, to be training with all the players down there. And you know, I think I've only been there for about eight to ten months there, down properly playing with their, you know, top seniors. So it has been really, really good for me. And you know, I'm sure even within the next 8 years, it will continue to improve me. Obviously, playing with the best in the country, you're never going to be as good as them when you first go in. So it is, as I say again, like, go through the processes of going into different environments, better levels of play, it is tough because sometimes you think that, you know, you're not good enough and you kind of don't really have as much motivation. But once you get to know everyone down there, it is really nice that they can support you and they can ask you what's up if you feel a bit down, or, you know, it is really nice to be down there.
Sure. And what have you learned from this, your time there? And is there anything that stands out for you in terms of the way other people train, or is it just the experience of being able to play with the best and learn from them?
I think, there has been a lot of things I've learned from there already. So I guess in terms of actual, you know, on-court badminton training matches, it is just really surprising to see the intensity and how high it actually is all the time down there. So I'm doing two, sometimes three sessions a day for like 4 days a week down there, and then training elsewhere. But it is, you know, for me, when I first went down there, I was really quite surprised by how physical it is, purely because it's just a higher intensity and everyone's really quick down there and very strong, and it does take a while for you to kind of get up to speed with the games. And I'm still not really there yet. I'm getting there, but it's taking a while. But I think another thing is just how much the players are prepared to do. It's just they'll train for 2.5 hours in the morning, and then they'll go to the gym after that, or they'll do some extra bits on court. And it is, you know, it's just surprising to see how much work goes into training, I guess.
Sure. In terms of that, how are you able to sort of maintain your energy levels and sort of motivation, say, for match play and compared to training? Is there certain things you do, or is it just you're always at 100% really?
Definitely it's difficult. The last few months I've found myself aching pretty much all the time, so it is very hard when you're going to the next session thinking, I'm not quite sure how I'm going to get through this, or, you know, this is going to be tough on my legs. It could be, for example, you have quite a physical session in the morning, and then you have an all-to-eat session in the afternoon that lasts for an hour and a half. So it is sometimes very, very hard work, which is obviously why it's nice to go home on the weekends. But I think a lot of the time you are just pushing through, really, pushing through the pain, the aching. It's just about getting the right rest, the right recovery, so sleeping in between sessions, making sure you eat the right things, being careful of, you know, kind of the food you eat, I guess, to make sure that you are recovering as best you can. And I guess it is as well important that you talk to people around there, and if you are struggling, then they can give you a few tips and ideas on how you might be able to recover better or quicker.
Sure. And in terms of that, what advice would you say to, if you were going to give advice to, say, a younger version of yourself, or another person who's looking to be like you and train in National Badminton Centre, what advice would you give in terms of pursuing the sport?
I think the key to it is definitely commitment. There is a lot of commitment involved, and you have got to be prepared to, you know, push yourself to very high limits whilst you're going through your whole career, not just in, if you want to get to National Badminton Centre, you know, it's before that, and making sure that you are doing everything you can to be at that level to get to the top. And it, you know, it's completely fine to feel, you know, not motivated or down or, you know, aching. Just, you know, stick with it and you then speak to someone, because there are a lot of people out there that can help you, especially if you're struggling with your mental confidence, or, you know, obviously you've got videos and this. So yeah, just if someone was looking to go down there, then just keep working hard and keep motivated.
Sure, and just finally, what are some of your future ambitions in the next few tournaments, and as you progress through the next few years in badminton, what are some of your aims?
I think it's quite hard to say at the minute, but for the next few tournaments, for me, I'm transitioning into senior, you know, high level tournaments now, so it is just about me playing those tournaments and getting the experience that I can from them and learning from them. Won't really be looking to win many, just learning, and the experience will be good for me. And I guess in the next few years, I'll be looking to go to hopefully senior European events and some high-level tournaments, and then be looking to get some results there. So at the minute, I think it is just about me and my partners learning and growing together and doing a lot of training so that I can be ready for, you know, the tournaments in the upcoming years, really.
Sure, and just finally, we'd just like to say all the very best, Hope, and we hope you have a great run in the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Sportspiel, available on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you once again to Hope and also to Yash for conducting that interview. We hope everyone enjoyed it, as always, on the show. Now it is time for part two. And for those who are, of course, familiar with Sportspiel, that is time for the news roundup section. In a nutshell, it is the part of the show where myself and Will go back and forth and give you, the listeners, a rundown of some of the stories, the news stories that caught our eye in the world of sport recently. We each get 2 minutes to talk about it, so it's very much a quick-fire round. Will has got the timer ready on his phone. Do we have a duck
announcer? As always, the duck is ready.
Cool. So, taking us away this time around with his first story is Will.
I'm going to keep up the positivity that I tried to create the last time we did a new section, because before then I'd been quite negative. So we'll start off on a high note, and that is the return of the English County Championship. Back for another season, 6 months of non-stop cricket, so a lot of excitement to be had there, and already England players in the runs, in the wickets. Joe Root, England captain, off the back of a mixed winter, shall we say, across test matches, one days, Big Bash and stuff like that. Got some good scores for Yorkshire, a century and a 94, another half century. Keaton Jennings with a 50-odd for Lancashire the other day. Ben Foulkes has got some runs, as well as a few players that are vying for contention to break into or back into this England lineup for this summer's Ashes. So Gary Balance has already hit 200s, David Malan's hit 100, and Haseeb Hameed, the forgotten man of English cricket, burst onto the international scene in 2016 with some good runs against India in India, which is not an easy achievement at all. Had really difficult 2 years after that, but came back and scored 218 in a warm-up game against Loughborough before scoring 100 not out as we speak for Lancashire in their opening county championship match. So a lot of good stuff there, but I mean, we've got to give a shout out to Ollie Robinson.
Woohoo.
We are our second ever guest on the show, my first ever interviewee, a good mate of mine, broke into the Kent first 11 at the end of last season, scored a few runs but nothing to set the world on fire. Played in the first game of the season as specialist wicketkeeper for the first time. Didn't get many runs in a loss to Somerset, but in his second game, put in a magnificent performance with 143. His first ever first-class century. What an achievement. Great to see him. Really, really proud of him. And there's going to be plenty more where that comes from.
Absolutely. Love it when we get to see people that we've had on, well, nearly 2 years ago now, doing really, really well for themselves and fulfilling that promise that we always said was in there. It was just a case of waiting to see it actually flourish. So always good to see it when
I remember. I remember being 10 or 11 years old and going to my first training session at our club, Sid Cup, of which I knew his dad and Ollie, they were neighbours of ours. I remember seeing Ollie as this 7-year-old, and he was better than all of us. And you knew then he had something special about him. And then to see his progression and to see him now scoring runs as a professional cricketer in Division 1 cricket as well. It's not Division 2 anymore, it's Division 1 against a decent Warwickshire attack. Very proud of him, and I know a lot of us who know him are. So good on you, mate, and keep going.
Exactly, we'll see those run scores racking up even more. My turn now on the news roundup duty, and kicking off with a story that we actually all mentioned a few episodes back. That is the case in Argentinian football. The Argentinian club San Lorenzo de Almagro, they announced the signing of the country's first professional women's football contracts. It's a very historic moment for the sport in South America, of course, where women footballers have long been treated as second-class citizens, I suppose, compared to their male counterparts. In a press conference this week, Matias Lamens, who's the president of San Lorenzo, announced the signing of 15 professional contracts for their women's team, including Macarena Sanchez, who was the footballer who was leading that protest in the first place, because when we brought it up last time, she was actually going to be suing the club and the Argentinian Federation over these lack of contracts. Team captain Eliana Medina was also another player who got awarded one of the contracts. San Lorenzo will fully finance 8 of the contracts. The rest will be paid for partially by the Argentinian FA. And of course, in March, the AFL announced that it would create and support a countrywide professional women's football league, pledging to give around $3,000 as a monthly subsidy to clubs that would sign a minimum of 8 women to professional contracts. Historical moment, obviously. Really good move for women's football in Argentina. But again, when I read out the sum of $3,000, kind of sums up where we are in terms of financial disparity between the men's game and the women's game, pointing out that there's still a long way to go, but definitely a step in the right direction, and Macarena Sanchez can write her name into history as the pioneer who pushed for this in the first place.
It's just a shame that it had to take so much negativity and protesting to get these contracts. They should be awarded for the hard work they do, not because they're complaining about it. But it's interesting to see as well discussions in the last couple of weeks about turning the Tyrrells 15s into a professional league as well. Obviously, some clubs like Saracens and Quins have a lot of centrally contracted players in their squad, but that's for their nation. But there's potentially thought that we could have professional women's rugby clubs in this country before long. So changes are happening, and it's good. Everything's going in a good direction.
Absolutely. On to next story.
Sticking with the positivity, and this week, British weightlifting have had their most successful ever European weightlifting championships. And that's still with 2 athletes to go as we record on Saturday morning. They've still got 1 male and 1 female athlete to compete this afternoon who could bring home yet more medals. But earlier this week, Zoe Smith, arguably one of British sport's most forgotten names, having been such a teenage star, breaking the British record at London 2012, winning Commonwealth Gold in 2014. It's been ravaged by injury for 2 years, and then obviously with the funding cut. It's been difficult, but she came back with a silver medal, an unexpected silver medal at the Commonwealth Games last year. Followed that up with her second ever European bronze earlier this week. Added to that was a silver for Emily Musket, formerly known as Emily Godley. She won an very impressive gold in the under 75 category at the Gold Coast because she came in at less than 71 kilos, whereas her competitors were all around the 73-74 mark. So to actually win that gold is impressive. She's now down at the 71 kilo category for this European Championships, came away with an impressive silver. The Russian woman who won the gold was a mile ahead of everyone else, but she was the best of the rest, and it was a brilliant performance. It's been a difficult time for weightlifting, having had their funding cut since Rio. They were having to use GoFundMe pages and crowdfunding sources to go to the World Championships last year. But UK Sport and the National Lottery have brought in the Aspiration Fund to help athletes like Godley and like Smith qualify for Tokyo 2020. And already, it seems to be paying off. So obviously, they're not guaranteed, as far as I'm aware, to be qualified as yet. But these European ranking points carry major significance, so we could see at least two British weightlifters at Tokyo, which is going to be fantastic.
And you mentioned the Aspiration Fund there, something we've talked about a few times in the past. But what we said before we pressed record this time around is, what could they have done if they'd had that funding from the very start? Because that was
or even a year earlier.
Because that was always the argument from relevant sports bodies who were getting that money from the aspiration funds, is it's all well and good getting that money, but we could have done with it 6 months before, a year before, to really get the full benefits of whatever program it is that they're on. Point to throw out there.
One thing is, British weightlifting lost one of its most exciting young talents in Rebecca Tyler. 19 years old, looks set to compete at major international championships, but when the funding was cut, she retired. And who knows how, I mean, she could yet come back, but who knows, if she'd had the funding, she could be winning European golds now. But it's good to see a sport where British success has been so low for a few years, it seems to be transitioning, and it's great to see women leading the way.
As always. Moving on now to my second story, and technically not a news story. This was an article that came out a couple of weeks ago now, but is definitely still worth mentioning, since this is obviously the first episode we've had as a duo for quite some time. That is an article that was written by Paralympic cyclist Hannah Dines. She wrote a blog piece for The Guardian at the end of March in which she opened up on why she actually needed vulva surgery. She used the piece to call for serious and urgent research into better saddles for females and female riders because of the years of pain and swelling that which was caused by friction as she rode, and it led her down a pathway where she actually needed surgery in the end. She's only 25, by the way, nearly 26, but just shows just how much damage was done in a relatively short space of time. But what made that article such a good read was that she managed to combine a lot of humour with quite a sensitive subject, because perhaps it's easy for me to say because we're both men, but it's not something we would have thought about, I think, as an actual struggle for a cyclist or a women cyclist. And for a lot of female athletes, I'm sure it's probably something that they would naturally feel a little bit not quite so keen on putting that out there in the first place, because it's obviously a very personal subject. So a piece that I think definitely needed to be written, and big up to Hannah Dines for actually putting it out there in the first place, and hopefully it raises the issue for a lot more women and they won't suffer in silence if they're a keen cyclist. And it might actually bring forth some developments in saddle technology as well in the future.
Well, as you said, I never realised that their saddles were designed for men.
Essentially.
I thought they were... Obviously, the difference between the male and the female bodies would make sense to have different saddles for both. So why have one designed for men and not one designed for women?
Exactly. When she says it, actually sounds quite very obvious.
Just sounds very stupid that there isn't one in place.
Exactly. And then it was clear that the long-term damage that has actually caused her.
Oh, dear. Sometimes it's just amazing how, when it comes to gender equality in sport, it's the basics that we're not doing right. Like specific like saddles for men and women.
Yep. Final story.
Final story. You. And this is a rule change that has caused some debate on Twitter this week, but perhaps not as much as first feared. And that is the bringing in of the half game regulation by the RFU. So in short, this is a new ruling which states that all age grade players, those aged 6 to 18, playing a game of rugby, have to play at least half a game. So ensure everyone gets the most enjoyment, learns the most, basically gets the most out of it. And it's sad for me, as good as this rule is, it's sad that we need this, because that suggests there are coaches out there with kids who want to play rugby and aren't being given enough game time for whatever reason. It's just, it brings back personal memories for me, being a footballer, spending, you know, you go to training week in, week out, and then you go on a Sunday morning, you'd go a long way, your parents would give up their morning for you, and sometimes I wouldn't even come off the bench. Sometimes you get a minute. There was one occasion playing a seven-a-side game where I came on as a sub for 5 minutes and then was bought off again for no real reason. So yeah, it's sad that this has been brought in, but I think it's going to be good for the benefit of the game. The statistics seem to point out that this is a good move as well. in terms of improving, the University of Essex found that it improves enjoyment of the game, self-esteem, and it improves skill competence. The more you play, the better you get. Obviously, you can do all the training you like, but the best place to learn is on the pitch. So it's a great initiative. It seems to be very well taken. I think 85% of coaches think it's a positive change. Let's see how it develops and whether other team sports will take it up, because it isn't fair on kids to give up all that time and then not be picked because, I don't know what, they're a rival to the coach's son or daughter, which just seems ridiculous, really.
Likewise. Interesting to see how it pans out, but when you're that age in particular, I think it's more important to actually play and learn and experience what it's like to play that sport. Too much of an emphasis on winning at that age when there really shouldn't be. That comes down to coaches and to parents. So, interesting to see how that goes.
I mean, my own experiences of that have meant that I don't want my kids, if I ever am lucky enough to have kids that want to be sporty, I don't want them to play football because I don't want them to experience what I had to go through when I was younger. I'd much rather they do an individual sport or they do a team sport like rugby, where things don't seem to, well, I didn't think things were as bad, but clearly rugby has had its own issues as well.
Exactly. Moving on then to my final story, which, after the positive vibes that we've had so far in this news roundup section, I'm going to be bringing the tone right back down to earth.
Boo.
Thank you. That is bad news for British canoeing, because an independent review's draft report into the body said that there was an environment in which abusive behaviour could thrive and athletes were too scared to challenge decisions. An inquiry into the body, which is one of the country's best funded and most successful sporting bodies, was launched back in 2017 after serious allegations surfaced about a coach. The panel's draft confidential report, which was seen this week by BBC Sport, claims that the former staff member was allowed to reoffend while hiding in plain sight, years after rumours and complaints of serious sexual misconduct first surfaced. It's another body described by an independent panel who were reviewing it as creating a culture of fear. We said that before we started recording as well, that is a phrase we've heard quite frequently recently, and again sums up just how important it is to remember that athletes are, first and foremost, people and human beings, and you should still be treating them as such rather than creating this bullying culture and trying to use results and medal-winning performances as some sort of excuse to actually back it up. So when you've got an environment where people are terrified of speaking out, something is clearly very wrong there, and there's going to be a long period of self-reflection, I feel, for British canoeing in the near future.
It's just amazing how one person can have so much power effectively and almost come across as untouchable, and it's a shame because British canoeing last two Olympics in particular have done so well, so many good performances, so many talented athletes in there, and to hear that it's been undermined by this culture of fear, for want of a less used phrase, is worrying, and it's disappointing. But hopefully that now that this coach is out of the way, things are better. Hopefully.
Fingers crossed. That is it for the news roundup section. More is to come after this.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel to find our episodes and other video content.
On to this episode's discussion section now, and we turn to the rather depressing subject of Australian rugby international Israel Folau. The player's international career was plunged into jeopardy after posting on his Instagram account this week proclaiming that hell awaits drunks, homosexuals, adulterers, liars, fornicators, thieves, atheists and idolaters. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given we are in 2019, after all, the criticism that came his way was profound, and Australian rugby officials look set to end his contract with the team. So, in short, we'll kick this off by briefly touching upon what we thought of his comments. Would you like to weigh in?
I didn't like them. I didn't agree with them.
I mean, considering I was also out last night drinking, I mean, hell awaits me if his post is true.
As a person without faith, hell also seemingly therefore awaits me.
Yeah, probably quite a few people in this room, or in this city, in this country.
Listening to this podcast.
Pretty much everyone. Obviously, it's no secret that he obviously has deeply Christian beliefs and a Christian background. So, to play devil's advocate, if we are preaching tolerance and tolerance of other people's culture and belief, should we not be preaching tolerance here?
But this is an extreme belief, and extremism isn't something we want in our society, really, is it? Apart from extremely good vibes, we want them, but this isn't an example of that. It's obviously he's entitled to his beliefs, and he can believe what he wants. It's a free society. We're not going to dictate how he should be feeling, what he should be believing. That's the way he's been brought up. That's what he feels, what he understands, and that's fine. But he should be able, as an international athlete and as a fairly well-educated man, he should be able to understand that those views he has aren't going to be well received in society, because there are a lot of people who have much milder views or just don't believe that at all. And yeah, he is a very minority extreme view that believes that, and he should respect that other people aren't going to be like him, and he doesn't necessarily have to like that, but he doesn't have to go about criticizing them and effectively threatening them.
I've always essentially gone down the line of it's fine to have your different cultures and your different backgrounds and your different beliefs, so long as you are not infringing on someone else's right to hold their belief and live the life they want to live their life. And obviously, if you're preaching to homosexuals that they were going to be burning in hell, I feel the line has been crossed there somehow. And looking back from a totally non-emotion point of view, it's not really something worth throwing your international career away for, which if I was his agent right now, I would be kicking myself. And
if I was his international teammates, I'd be furious.
Livid this week.
It's a World Cup year, and he's come out and said that. And it's not the first. The thing is, it's not the first time he's done this either. He's said things across the last 2 or 3 years. He's been warned enough times.
Well, that's
once is enough.
Once is enough. But that kind of throws into my
overall.
You should
be able to learn from that.
Wider question then: World Cup year. How much does this actually affect Australia not having him?
It could cost them the World Cup. It genuinely could cost them the World Cup. This is a decent Australian team. Not necessarily the best they've ever fielded, but there's some great talent in there. And he was undoubtedly one of the star players. He's unbelievable. On his day, he is unbelievably good. And he's gone and thrown that all the way, potentially. They haven't actually officially sacked him yet. But
I think we all know it's essentially coming.
They can't now not sack him, having said they were going to. So,
exactly. Briefly touch upon some of my favourite reactions to his Instagram post. I think we both agreed that Joe Marler, of course, England international, his social media activity was arguably the best, purely for its humour, in which he tweeted, I think, a series of GIFs of men making out and tagging Israel Folau in every single one. Got a host of likes that one, including from me. But moving on to another England international, less positive news again, and that's Billy Vunipola, because the RFU said that they will be holding a meeting next week with the player after he defended Folau's comments. Vunipola had liked the post that Folau had posted on his Instagram, and following understandable criticism again that came his way from other users, he posted his own statement on Friday on his Instagram account. In it, he said, "So this morning, I got 3 phone calls from people telling me to unlike the Izzy Folau post. This is my position on it. I don't hate anyone, neither do I think I'm perfect. There just comes a point when you insult what I grew up believing in that you just say enough is enough. What he's saying isn't that he doesn't like or love those people. He's saying how we live our lives needs to be closer to how God intended them to be. Man was made for women to procreate. That was the goal, no? I'm not perfect. I'm at least everything on that list, at least at one point in my life. It hurts to know that, but that's why I believe there's a God to guide and protect us and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. That's what he posted on Instagram. And again, has landed him in hot water. Not quite to the extent that Israel Folau has landed himself in hot water with his national federation, but I think Billy Vindipola can expect at least a harsh talking to this week.
And again, not just from his coaches, but from his teammates as well, because it seems like he is trying to defend Folau on what Folau's come out and said, which is, again, it's fine to believe in what you believe in. No one can tell you otherwise. You believe what you want to believe, but it's not really defensible what he said. In current society where we are being more tolerant and accepting of people as they are, in a very mixed world in terms of religious beliefs and things like that, it's wasn't his smartest move.
No.
Also, he seems to contradict himself in that interview, in that Instagram post as well, by saying, you know, man was born to create children with women. And yet he says he's been everything on that list at least once in his life. Does that mean he's been homosexual? I mean, that's definitely not the right way of looking at it. But, you know, he's just sort of contradicting himself and just makes himself look
exactly.
silly.
But I suppose the ultimate point here is that if you are a high caliber sports person up there in the public eye, you have a responsibility that goes along with your sporting talent and your sporting performances, which was summed up in the statement that Saracens gave out in relation to the Vinopolo case, because they said, "We recognise that people have different belief systems and we expect everyone to be treated equally with respect and humility." This is the key point. "As representatives and role models, Saracens players have a responsibility not only to themselves but to the club and wider society. Billy Vunipola's recent social media posts are inconsistent with this, and we take this matter very seriously. It will be handled internally." That's ultimately the point, in that if you are in that position, you have a duty to society, not just yourself, when you've got a platform like Billy Vunipola has, for example.
But an interesting point on the sort of the role model and thing in the public eye was that, it's really annoying, I can't remember who it was, but an athlete came out a few weeks ago and said that a lot of athletes haven't signed up to be role models, and why should they be seen as role models when they're just doing their job? But it's like, well, but you're doing your job in the public eye. People are looking for you for inspiration to guide them, to make them feel better, etc., etc. So why you automatically, by signing up to become a professional athlete, are signing up to become a role model as well? And therefore, you do have to think more carefully about what you say.
It's part
if I was to say that, those sorts of things on my social media account, I would most likely be fired from my job, because that's not fitting with my company's views, and it's extremist, and it can be classified as hate speech. So why should professional athletes think they should be treated differently?
Well, likewise, same as me. I am lucky enough in that I have a platform where I can write whatever I like, essentially, and it could be published. But if I write something like that, it's obviously going to get me fired in one way, because as a journalist, a reporter, I sort of have a duty to society. That's part of the package of my job. Same comes in here. But anyway, on that positive note, we'll bring this discussion section to a close. More is to come after this.
Follow SportsspielPod on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram, or go to our website, sportsspielonline.com.
On now to my favourite part of the show, Ask Alistair, where Will prepares two incredibly vague questions for me, asks me one, which I'll try and get right in order to score some points, and then the second one gets asked to you, the audience, to play along at home, obviously without Google, because that's not
cheating.
The game. So, handing over to you, what are my choices this week?
So, having got half a point last time out for the cheese rolling question, your choices this week are the 1936 Olympics or Japan.
Tenuous again. Let's say Japan.
What is the national sport of Japan? Oh, come on.
No, wait, no, because this is going to be one that's...
You will know this.
Is this going to be
you
one
really
that's
know this.
Tenuous, or no. Is it right there in my face?
Yeah, it's right there in your face.
Is it sumo?
Yay!
Yes!
See, it wasn't that difficult.
Hallelujah.
So you're up to 1.5 points. Congratulations.
Nice one. They got it straight off the bat this time.
So the question for the audience is, how many golds did Jesse Owens win at the 1936 Olympics? Would Alistair have got that straight away?
Not straight away, no.
So yeah, that you have until the next episode to answer that question and write in, let us know. Congratulations to all those who correctly identified Twickenham as being the ground that was formerly a cabbage patch. So I can't remember off the top of my head who wrote in, but at least one person did.
It was
right
a while
answer.
Ago. So
it's been a little while, but yeah, congratulations, Alistair. Yeah. I'm going to have to come up with harder questions next time.
Please don't. on with that. Final messages to come after this short break. Right, that is almost it for this latest episode of the podcast. If you can hear the rustling in the background, that is Will packing away his computer before he legs it to Lee Valley to do some hockey work. As always, do follow us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. All of our handles are SportsspielPod, so you can find us there. Likewise, you can get in touch. Our email address is sportsspielpod@gmail.com. We are going to be back next week on April the 20th. The reason behind that, because it's only a week away, is it's our birthday. 2 years since the podcast launched, so we'll be releasing a special episode to commemorate that and obviously tell you all about what is coming up in the near future, because we have some big plans. That is it from me and from Will. I'll be filling in for him until the end. Thank you so much for tuning in, listeners, and we will see you in a week's time.